UK government might have shut down?
Let's end this shutdown right now. Let's put people back to work.
Listen, there's never been a president in our history that did not negotiate over the debt limit. Never. Not once.
But you can count on us. Welcome to News One Now with Roland Martin.
Good morning. I'm Monique Presley, in for the hardest working, unapologetically black man in the business, Roland Martin. Coming up now on News One Now, a stunning reprimand on the Senate floor as Republicans vote to silence Senator Elizabeth Warren's comments during a debate about Attorney General nominee Jeff Sessions' civil rights record. We'll tell you all about it. President Donald Trump is defiant. He says he will take his travel ban fight to the Supreme Court, calling it common sense. While a federal appeals court is set to rule on whether to reinstate the ban after holding oral arguments yesterday. We'll update you. Also, Florida's Stand Your Ground law is revisited just as Marissa Alexander is freed after serving a total of 5 years for what many believe was self-defense. We discuss the law's pending amendments with her later in the show. And the author of Hidden Figures, the book that inspired the movie, will join us to talk about her nomination for an NAACP Image Award. News One Now starts right now. Fireworks in the U.S. Senate last night as Democrats put up a fight against some of President Donald Trump's most controversial cabinet nominees. Aren't they all controversial? In a stunning move last night, Republicans voted to bar Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren from speaking on the Senate floor while she was quoting a 1986 letter by the late Coretta Scott King that criticized Attorney General nominee Jeff Sessions' civil rights record. At the time, Sessions had been up for a federal judgeship. Majority Leader Mitch McConnell accused Warren of impugning the motives and conduct of the Alabama senator and called for Warren to be silenced. But the Massachusetts Democrat refused to back down.
Mr. President.
The Majority Leader.
The senator is impugning the motives and conduct of our colleague from Alabama, as warned by the chair. Senator Warren, quote, said Senator Sessions has used the awesome power of his office to chill the free exercise of the vote by black citizens. I call the senator to order under the provisions of Rule 19.
Mr. President.
The senator from Massachusetts.
Mr. President, I am surprised that the words of Coretta Scott King are not suitable for debate in the United States Senate. I ask leave of the Senate to continue my remarks.
Is there objection?
Object.
I appeal the ruling.
Objection is heard. The senator will take her seat.
The Senate is scheduled to vote on Senator Sessions' nomination later today. Last night's move means Senator Warren won't be able to speak on the floor of the Senate until after the debate on Sessions is closed. Senator Warren commented on the incident via Twitter. She tweeted, "I will not be silent while the Republicans rubber stamp an AG who will never stand up to the president when he breaks the law." She also tweeted, "Tonight, Leader Mitch McConnell silenced Mrs. King's voice on the Senate floor, and millions who are afraid and appalled by what's happening in our country." Joining us to talk about all this is Congressman Bobby Scott of Virginia. He is the top Democrat on the House Education and the Workforce Committee. Wow. What do we say to these things? Mitch McConnell basically has said to Senator Warren, go in the corner and sit down.
That episode was so bizarre on so many different levels. First of all, you're silencing one of the leading liberal voices in the country on an issue involving the nomination of the Attorney General. How can the one who is supposed to protect civil rights, how can the words of Coretta Scott King be out of order? I mean, just on all levels, to have the rule actually says you can't say anything, essentially can't say anything bad about another senator. If he is up for a nomination, how can you restrict the comments to only nice things about him? How are you going to have a debate on his nomination if you can't have the good and the bad? It's just so bizarre on many levels. And so if they're going to force his nomination through and limit the debate and restrict only good things to be said about him, that it's just bizarre to call that a debate at all.
Well, many people hadn't even heard of this rule, Rule 19, probably before last night. But what seems clear to me as an attorney is that this rule is meant to maintain decorum between senators when they're engaged in debate so that the debate doesn't devolve into name-calling, et cetera. It's not, and I don't think the founders even intended when they were writing this, whoever drafted this decorum rule, that when you agree to put your name in for a nomination for an appointment to a cabinet, that then your record can't be questioned, which is basically what was being done through Mrs. King's letter.
That's why it is so bizarre that you're going to have a debate on the fitness of a person to hold an office, and you can't say anything bad about them. You can only say good things. I mean, it's just silly. I mean, if you go back, and I'm sure some things were said about Senator Tower. I think he was, maybe he might have been a former senator. But you cannot have a coherent debate if you can, if you can't say anything negative about the senator. Invoking that rule was just meant to silence the Senator Warren. She was making an effective point, and they just wanted to silence her. And it is for the Attorney General, one who is supposed to be protecting your First Amendment rights, to silence someone in violation of the spirit of the First Amendment. I guess you got certain liberties on the Florida Senate, but how can you limit someone's freedom of speech when they're talking about a nomination, and you're supposed to be having a debate, and you can only say good things about the candidate? You want to restrict the debate for your candidate, you can only say good things about the candidate. That's just...
Well, this is another example.
That's just bizarre, particularly for the position of Attorney General.
Right, which is one of the most critical appointments ever. I want to bring in the rest of my panel. Joining us today, we have Dr. Greg Carr, Chair of the Department of Afro-American Studies at Howard University, HU, and Clint Smith, the author of Counting Dissent. Look, Dr. Greg, just as a black woman in America, I take personal exception to the notion that they would choose to shut down Coretta King's letter, a letter that, if truth be told, decades ago,
that's right,
Strom Thurmond chose to not put in the record. So this woman's voice was quashed then, and now coming through another woman, one of the most powerful women in the country, she's bringing it into the record after it was already brought out in committee, and Mitch McConnell says go sit in a corner.
Well, Counselor, you should be offended. We should all be offended, as Congressman Scott says. I mean, you know, Marimba Ani, the sociologist, refers to this as the rhetorical ethic. That's why every debate in Congress begins with "my friend." We all know you don't mean it, but, you know, what we saw yesterday was Colonel McConnell rising in Kentucky as a strain of Dixie played in his head, had to defend the honor of his fellow Confederate, Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III, against a black woman from Marion, Alabama. This is Coretta Scott King. It wasn't even about Elizabeth Warren, although it was in terms of the politics, as the Congressman said. But the bigger issue is here, she was reading from that letter. And so what you see is, you know, it is very interesting. You know, I seem to remember a caustic junior senator from Texas, Ted Cruz, who called Mitch McConnell a liar on the floor of the United States Senate, and he didn't invoke Rule 19 for him. So what you see here is not only a double standard, but a triple standard. And you should be offended, Counselor, because Coretta Scott King's words are truer now than they were when she spoke, when she wrote them 31 years ago.
But isn't it amazing? So what he does, and for whatever the reasons were that he decided he wanted to silence it, of course what it did is amplify. It amplified her letter. It empowered Warren. I was up last night and Rachel Maddow had her on immediately, and then she took to Facebook. Over 1.5 million views now.
That's right.
of her reading the entire letter. So what do you make of this? I mean, was this a successful ploy on the part of the Republicans, or are we now back again with a groundswell from the public?
It was a strange move because Mitch McConnell is often sort of espoused as this sort of master of understanding the rules of the Senate and how to sort of manipulate them in an effective manner. But this was a strange decision, both in part because silencing Coretta Scott King sort of runs counter to any notion of decorum, so to speak, that we understand, but also that it is seemingly going to create a sort of groundswell of support for Elizabeth Warren. And as you said, one of the people who's the most important and progressive voices in this country, and bring attention to something that was happening that many people otherwise simply wouldn't have been paying attention to. And I think the irony is also that in those 40-some-odd senators who sort of signed on with support and voted alongside Mitch McConnell to silence Coretta Scott King's letter and what she was saying, is that so many of those people, I'm sure if you went back a few weeks ago, were celebrating the life and legacy, or their notion of the legacy of Martin Luther King, right? And so it goes to show you the ways in which, especially folks on the right, will sort of render a caricature of Dr. King and not reckon with the sort of totality of his legacy and the totality of what he and both Coretta stood for. And I think that this is a prime example of that happening.
Right, and this is an example, again, about people not really wanting to give full voice to her legacy and the legacy of many women of the civil rights movement. But Congressman Scott, I need to talk about Mitch McConnell for a minute. This is not the first blatant power grab we've seen from him. I'm reminded of a certain time for the fall of last year when he flat out refused to call for a vote to even have hearings on Jeff Garland's nomination for the Supreme Court, or Merrick Garland's nomination for the Supreme Court. And now we're seeing the same thing with Jeff Sessions, him pushing through what he wants to push through, holding what he wants to hold, telling people to sit down when he wants them to sit down. What's going on?
The Merrick Garland situation, I think, should not be ignored, because if you look at the three branches of government, the Supreme Court is constituted by appointments from presidents. And so if you win the presidency, you can affect the Supreme Court. What happened last year was that a appointment that should have been made by a Democratic president was stonewalled. Essentially, and one of the senators said stolen. And a Republican will get that appointment. Now, well, if you go back 24 years, eight with Clinton, Bush, and Obama, 16 of the 24 years, Democrats have been in control. So you'd think only one person was appointed before that. All of them appointed. You would think that just the ordinary rotation, that we would have a majority of the court, and that would have been the fifth Democratic appointment, and now it's going to be a Republican appointment. I mean, you're talking about the ability to enforce voting rights and all of the things that the Supreme Court considers. How do you just ignore the fact that a Democrat was supposed to get the appointment? And there was no, they say, well, you don't do this in an election year. It's never happened in an election year. I looked back. I couldn't find a vacancy in an election year. People don't retire in an election year. Nobody died during an election year, maybe for the last 50 years. So every time there's been a vacancy in an election year, it's been filled.
Right.
Well, because there hadn't been one.
Right, and I think in all of our history, there's only been one other time.
You just can't ignore the fact that the normal course has been disrupted by an outrageous. There's plenty of time. I mean, there was plenty of time to go through an appointment. The Kennedy was appointed, was confirmed during an election year.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Now, you had Bork appointed and defeated. Ginsburg was the Harvard Law professor, was appointed and withdrew, and then they appointed Kennedy. You did all of that. You had enough time to do all of that,
right,
and still have him in place by the first Monday in October, beginning of this Supreme Court session. So there's no time problem.
Well, look,
it takes about 3 months.
It was the same as last night, a direct disrespect for last night, Warren's ability to speak on the floor, for President Obama,
really a direct disrespect of his right. And they said, let's let the voters decide. But, you know, it's obvious. The voters elected the president, and it was up to the president to decide. What I don't want to get missed, though, Dr. Gregg, is they blocked the nomination last year. Mm-hmm. So then we end up with this conservative nominee for Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. And we add to that Jeff Sessions. Sure. For Attorney General.
Sure.
When we've got people wanting to overturn Roe v. Wade.
Of course.
We've got people wanting to basically pull down every gain that civil rights movement has taken in the past 10 years if they can get a hold to it. Never mind issues on voting. Talk to me about the politics that's involved and what we can do to stop it, because it seems that we're out of power.
Well, that's the focus. I think, you know, the Democrats are going to have to decide whether they want to fight or not. The Republicans are trying to hold on to not just political power, but a way of life. Mitch McConnell has been rather feckless and ghoulish in this. When the president was elected, as we know, he said, it's my job to make him a one-term senator. What he did with the Supreme Court nomination is utterly indefensible if we're talking about fairness in politics, as Congressman Scott is talking about. But if we're talking about naked power, it's absolutely defensible. You know, people got caught up in two senators from the Republican Party defecting on the Betsy DeVos nomination. They didn't defect. The Republican Party can count. They knew smiling Mike Pence was going to come down and break that tie. Two of them might defect because the Senate has been in session all night last night and the night before. Two of them might defect on Jeff Sessions to save face. And then we get caught up in, oh, can we get one more person? No, you can't. Don't you know that Olympia Snow and them went over and talked to them and said, we're going to go over to make it look like we're being reasonable. You got to listen to Chuck Grassley yesterday talking about Jeff Sessions. You got to listen to Orrin Hatch come up and say, oh, I lament the lack of decorum in the Senate. That's all theater. This is about naked politics. And Congressman Scott has been fighting for years. His colleagues in the Congress, now in the Senate, the Democrats will have to decide whether they're going to play the same kind of hardball the Republicans are. Otherwise, we are going to have to abandon both parties and run out of some political power on our own.
All right, we're going to talk about that next. Coming up next on News One Now, Betsy DeVos has been sworn in as the nation's new education secretary. We'll discuss that. Also, a federal appeals court in San Francisco listened to arguments from the Justice Department and Washington State last night as they battled over Trump's travel ban executive order. Plus, I'll talk to the author of Hidden Figures, the book that inspired the movie, about our nomination for the 48th annual NAACP Image Awards. Stay with us. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
So you want the truth. Well, we got it.
That's how I talk. God knows it. I'm just straight.
It's News One Now.
Betsy DeVos has been sworn in as the nation's new education secretary, probably the most uneducated education secretary we've ever had, following efforts by Democrats to derail her confirmation. All 48 members of the Senate Democratic Caucus, along with two Republicans, voted against her. But Vice President Mike Pence came in and cast the tie-breaking vote. DeVos is a big supporter of school vouchers and charter schools.
The Vice President votes in the affirmative and the nomination is...
So, look, this woman apparently bought her way into a nomination, mm-hmm. by all accounts. She didn't just support this new president. Can I use air quotes? President. but also hundreds of thousands of dollars spent on the elections of people who voted for her nomination.
Yes.
I'm not saying this has never happened before, but when you have somebody who is as unqualified for the job as she is, it's incredible. Where do we go from here? Because to me, what I keep thinking about when I think about stuff like this is vote. Voting matters.
Certainly. And this is sort of feels like, in many ways, an almost legal case study in corruption, right? I mean, I think that it is, I won't say it's unprecedented, because unfortunately, with the passing of Citizens United, there has been a sort of influx of money that influences the sort of legislative decisions that are made, both in a sort of congressional, Senate, and the, in the executive branch. But I taught high school English for several years in Prince George's County, right up the road. And to put someone who is so fundamentally incompetent, who is so fundamentally incapable of understanding the most basic precedents of federal education law, in charge of the money that many of these states need and that is necessary for them to put forth the programs that that are responsible for this sort of upward academic and social mobility of our students is deeply frightening. And I think that, you know, clearly the Republicans have prioritized party over public education, and I've put somebody in place who is a sort of advocate of a free market notion of what education should look like. But the problem with the free market is that in a free market, there are winners and losers. And public education is a system in which we shouldn't have certain children winning and certain children losing. But that is the priority that the administration has apparently made.
Well, look, but Dr. Gregg, when she was being confirmed, she didn't know what the IDEA was.
No.
I mean, for me, as a person with a child who takes advantage of special education in the schools and somebody who's had to go through years and years of IEPs, she was being asked these questions, and she's saying, well, it would be up to the parents to ensure that their children go to a school that offers, and she literally was in the Twilight Zone. You know, I'm not always on board with you when we start talking about white privilege and people with money and et cetera and et cetera, because I don't think they're all the same, but was this not the prime example?
Well, no. Not the same, as many poor whites are going to find out in the next 4 years. But as you've explained before, she doesn't even know the difference between federal and state law. But let's not lose focus. The Department of Education only controls about 10% of education budgets around the country. Most education budgets are state and local. The Department of Education is a cabinet position that's low-hanging fruit, and these people don't care. When we got to look at Steve Bannon and these cats in the White House. They're after bigger fish. Donald Trump is basically paying off, as you said, this is a patronage job, not an ambassadorship, but a cabinet. The Republicans voted lockstep with a little political theater at the end because they don't care about that. Now, when it comes to the fact that in Michigan, when she was funding using her daddy's Amway money and her brother who started Blackwater, the private security group, when they're funneling money for charter schools in Detroit, they didn't deal in the charters that she was funding with special ed. They said, well, send those kids over to the public schools. She doesn't care. She doesn't know. She doesn't care. They don't care in the government, and we've got to care about our own kids when we realize that education really should be a state and local issue, and we got to stop her from putting her fingers in education the best we can.
Congressman Scott, we got to pull on you while you're here. Look, voting matters, and this is a consequence of election. We're looking at some dire consequences, perhaps the likes of which we haven't seen before. What can constituents do at this point when we're looking at someone like DeVos, who really seems to be interested in divesting public school education?
I think if you look at her background and look at the hearings, that she did not show a lot of support for public schools. And so we have to put up the fight for public schools. It's going to be an interesting fight, because just yesterday, Republicans introduced a bill to abolish the Department of Education. Now, you're right, it's only 10% of the money, but with that money comes a commitment to civil rights, starting with the Brown decision, making sure that low-income students have a fair shot. We put the money where it's needed. IDEA, the people who are usually falling through the cracks, disabled, minorities, achievement gaps, that's what the money is for. And it's in the public schools. You talk about school choice. Yes. School choice has never been shown to increase education. The choice schools, so you take a voucher, go somewhere, the students do, on average, they do average. All you've done is taken money from the public schools. You could have used that money for something that worked. Smaller class sizes, better teacher professional development, early childhood education, after school programs, reading recovery, things you know actually work. And you use that money to pay for students, most of whom would have been in private school anyway. So you haven't done anything for the public schools, and that's where the fight's going to be. Last year, about a year ago, we passed the Every Student Succeeds Act. We made sure that the states had the responsibility of ascertaining achievement gaps and then curing the achievement gaps. Just this week, they've set aside many of the regulations that put that in effect. And so we've got to start from scratch, making that fight all over again. Achievement gaps, making sure everybody has a fair shot in the public education. And if you spend all your time on choice, We just have to put up the fight. We're not going to let them dismantle public education.
And states and municipalities are going to have to do their job. Look, yesterday, a federal appeals court heard oral arguments from attorneys representing the Department of Justice and Washington State on whether Trump's travel ban against citizens from seven mostly Muslim countries should be reinstated. The three-judge panel questioned attorneys for over an hour and said they would rule sometime this week. Trump's lawyers said the order was not a Muslim ban, but was derived from a list of countries the Obama administration created.
The executive order at issue puts a temporary pause on entry for individuals from seven countries that Congress and the last president determined in a similar context pose special risks in terms of terrorist infiltration into our country.
The attorney representing Washington State emphasized the need for the court to oversee what the White House was doing.
It has always been the judicial branch's role to say what the law is and to serve as a check on abuses by the executive branch. That judicial role has never been more important in recent memory than it is today. But the president is asking this court to abdicate that role here.
Trump, earlier in the day, said he was confident he would win and expressed dismay that his executive order would even be challenged in court.
We need this court case. It would be very helpful to keeping the wrong people out of our country. I actually can't believe that we're having to fight to protect the security in a court system to protect the security of our nation. I can't even believe it. ISIS said we are going to infiltrate the United States and other countries through the migration. And then we're not allowed to be tough on the people coming in? Explain that one.
Is it going to go to the Supreme Court, you think?
Good. I mean, we'll see. Hopefully it doesn't have to. It's common sense. You know, some things are law, and I'm all in favor of that. And some things are common sense. This is common sense.
Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly took the blame for the chaotic rollout, fell on his sword, over the travel ban, but insisted the current vetting process for travelers coming into the United States is weak and threatens the security of Americans.
I should have delayed it just a bit so that I could talk to members of Congress, particularly the leadership of committees like this, to prepare them for what was coming. I can tell you, because my people tell me, that for the last number of years, the vetting is at best loose. I believe the vetting on the other end right now is not adequate to protect the nation.
Still with me is Congressman Bobby Scott of Virginia and the rest of my panel, Dr. Greg Carr and Clinton Smith III. Wow. Kelly was a soldier to the end yesterday, wasn't he? I mean, he went in there and did what a good soldier does. He took responsibility for something it seems like he found out about when he was on a plane.
Well, they try to say it's not a Muslim ban. You could call it a cure for cancer. It's a Muslim ban. It targets those. And, you know, I have a problem with this that starts with the Iraq War. They said, oh, we got to protect against terrorism, we have to attack Iraq. Iraq didn't have anything to do with 9/11. Everybody, kind of the way you listen to discussion, you think that none of the hijackers came from Iraq, none. And so you have the same kind of situation here. You say, oh, we got to protect from terrorism. And you name these countries, not a single terrorist has come from these countries. All of the experts are saying you're actually enhancing terrorism. With this Muslim ban, you're making people mad, you're feeding into the dialogue of ISIS recruiting, so you're actually making things worse. But you have your Muslim ban, something that the president campaigned on, that Rudy Giuliani has kind of blurted out what the deal is. It says they want a Muslim ban, but want to camouflage it a little bit so it'll be legal. It's a Muslim ban. You can't do that. And so I'm hoping that the appellate court will allow them to present the evidence of what it is, the fact that it is not anything that will enhance national security. You just can't declare it to be something in national security. You have to show it. And there's no evidence that this enhances national security. In fact, you talk to most experts, it makes things worse. And so the stay remains.
Well, we just have a little bit more time. Mm-hmm. But to me, Dr. Gregg, mm-hmm.
isn't this just a propaganda rollout? I mean, isn't this what we do? There's not any nuance to it. This is step by step what is done by a leader when their entire objective is to roll out a false narrative.
Well, again, Trump's just a mouthpiece. You got to remember, Stephen Bannon, one of his pillars of his philosophy is this Christian versus Muslim war. You know, so when you look at this, and we listened to the orals last night, you know, when Judge Freeman asked the lawyer for justice, are you saying that we can't even review this? Should this even be reviewable? It was a pause, and he said, well, maybe not. Meaning what? The issue they're raising isn't the Muslim ban. The issue they're raising is the power of the presidency to actually sign these executive orders. There's an executive order being circulated now, it has leaked, which is considering adding the Muslim Brotherhood to the list of terrorist organizations. This is Steve Bannon. This was a test case. I don't think they're going to lift this. Why? Because it would create chaos. But you got to really look at the argument the government made yesterday. Their argument was about presidential authority. And see, this is setting in place for the thing that Congressman Scott is talking about, a war with Islam. And at that point, when do citizens, including African Americans named Muhammad, named Khadijah, start having to look over their shoulder, because you're starting to ban organizations now, and you're looking for a fifth column that doesn't exist except in the pages of Breitbart News in the country.
All right, hold on. We got to take a break and pay some people. Coming up next on News One Now, Margot Lee Shetterly, the author of Hidden Figures, the book that inspired the blockbuster movie, talks about her nomination for an NAACP award. This is News One Now.
The first step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number two, roll out.
The way I roll is, when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with Roland Martin. Roland Martin.
There's no protocol for women attending.
There's no protocol for a man circling the earth either, sir.
Every time we have a chance to get ahead, they move the finish line. Every time.
We all get there together, we don't get there at all.
It's good to know NASA hadn't given up on good old-fashioned brain power.
The movie Hidden Figures is nominated in several categories at the 48th annual NAACP Image Awards. And the book that inspired the movie Hidden Figures, The American Dream and the Untold Story of Black Women Mathematicians Who Helped the Space Race, is also nominated. Joining me now on Skype from New Haven, Connecticut, is author and Image Award nominee Margot Lee Shetterly. She has a chance to take home the award for Outstanding Nonfiction Literary Work. Margot, congratulations.
Thank you. Good morning. It's really nice to be here.
I mean, this is Black Girl Magic trifecta. We are all so excited. I know I am personally excited just for all the well-due respect that your movie and book are getting. What does this nomination mean to you?
Honestly, all of this has been so wonderful. It is an honor. You know, the NAACP is a part of this history. They are the ones who did the long and very difficult work to open, integrate schools, which is a big part of the story in my book. So it's a huge honor, you know, and all of the attention that this story and these women have been getting, it's marvelous. I mean, these are heroes, heroines, and they are getting the platform they deserve.
Well, look, the book and the movie are taking the world by storm. I think one of the reasons is because people simply didn't know and still don't know the role that women, especially African American women, played just in all different parts of our history, whether it's civil rights or whether it's in this case just affecting our trajectory in the world. What is it that inspired you to write this book?
Well, I was very fortunate because I knew a lot of these women growing up. You know, my dad, he's now retired. He worked at NASA. He worked with these women, but they were part of our community, you know. So I think part of the reason why the story wasn't told is because they were doing a lot of other things, like helping their kids with their calculus homework and, you know, carpooling and going to church, whatever. So, I think that that is, one of the reasons why we haven't heard this story before. But, you know, the other thing thing is this work that these women did was valued less than what the men did. And so, you know, I think that by kind of pulling the curtain back on history, what we really understand is that there are so many people doing the work to create those heroic moments that we see as the culmination of a movement, but it's really the culmination of the hard work of a lot of people.
Right, and still to this very day getting paid at a fraction of what a man's being paid for a same or lesser job, but I won't start. How did you feel watching your words come to life in the movie? I mean, what was that like to write something and then get to see it on the biggest screen there is?
It was amazing. The first time I saw it, I think I was kind of in a dream state, just like, you know, I can't believe this is actually happening, you know, and, I saw the movie and, you know, when I saw the final movie, I was just so impressed with, you know, all the work that, I mean, this was a real team effort. There were so many people involved in making this happen. And I'm thrilled. I love the movie. I've seen it like 6 times. I'm going to see it 2 more times this week.
Well, my daughter loved it. My girlfriends loved it. Everyone has just been raving about it. And this is much deserved success. So we wish you luck with the NAACP Image Awards and every place else that the movie is getting credit. We are expecting great things. Thank you so much for being with us, Margo. Did we lose Margo? All right. Thanks, Margo. We appreciate you. A new exhibit is set to be revealed at the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center in Cincinnati, Ohio. Next, Roland talked to the center's president about the announcement. George Washington obsessed for years over one of his slaves. We'll discuss why with the author of Never Caught coming up.
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
Marissa Alexander is finally free after completing 2 years of court-ordered home confinement and serving nearly 3 years in prison for firing a warning shot at her abusive husband. Her husband did not sustain any injuries from the warning shot, and Alexander had no previous criminal record. However, in 2012, at only 31 years old, Alexander was sentenced to 20 years in the Florida criminal correctional system. Alexander's defense argued that she was defending herself from her abusive, estranged husband. Based on the state Stand Your Ground law that freed George Zimmerman from the 2012 shooting of Trayvon Martin, the community cried for Alexander to be exonerated. Now officially free for the last few weeks, Alexander is joining us today by Skype from Jacksonville, Florida. Welcome to the show, Marissa.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I've got to tell you, after being on the show as a panelist while you were in home detention, I am so excited to know that you are free to come and go as you please, because you just never should have been in that position in the first place. But as you know, the Florida Senate Judiciary Committee voted 2 weeks ago in favor of an amendment that would shift the burden of proof to the prosecutor in the Stand Your Ground law. The proposal has now returned to the House. I know this has to be something that you're excited about now, but do you think this would have helped you 5 years ago?
Well, I believe that it would have helped me in the sense that it would have protected my Fifth Amendment right, which normally in a self-defense case, about 90% of the defendants have to justify, which means they have to testify. You don't necessarily have to, but in a self-defense case, you have to prove that you had to justify your defense, whatever it may be. So typically when you do an immunity hearing, you have to testify, and so you give up your Fifth Amendment right to testify, and that's so important and crucial to a defendant's ability to be able to remain silent and not pretty much give over the prosecution your defense early on in speaking, because that testimony can be used against you later on.
So how involved have you and your attorneys been in advocating for changes to the Stand Your Ground law? I know there wasn't much you could talk to us about it the last time we talked, but is there any update that you can give us now that you're free?
Well, at this point, tomorrow I will go to Tallahassee to the Capitol, and I will actually speak. I was invited by FAM, so I'll go on behalf of my organization, my new nonprofit, and I will speak to the committee there about the changes and how, why I'm necessarily for it. I've also created my nonprofit. I've spoken to just different colleges and different things like that to give them a different perspective, because it's one thing to hear it from the news, it's another thing to hear from the person that's actually, you know, in dealing with the situation. So I continue to be able to be involved. I mean, there's been certain cases or certain laws has changed as it's been inspired by my case. So I will continue in that effort with my nonprofit.
Well, thank you so much for not just sitting on the sidelines, but getting involved. The proposed amendment sponsored by Republican Florida State Senator Rob Bradley would shift the burden of proof from the defendant to the prosecutor. And many contend that the Stand Your Ground law is used more successfully as a defense for white shooters than African Americans. I'm going to go to my panel. Dr. Gregg, any thoughts or a question for Marissa?
No, I mean, you know, I'm glad to see you are advocating, and I guess if I had a question, it would probably be, how important do you feel it is for folks who have escaped the fell clutches of this system to communicate with those of us who are here the messages and the experiences and the need to advocate for those who remain caught in this system?
Yeah, I mean, it's extremely important. One of the things that I noticed is that I'm not just the only one. I mean, there are plenty of women and there are plenty of men. People reach out to me all the time, and I just want to be able to be a voice for them. As you mentioned earlier, it does seem to work more in favor. I mean, the data actually backs that up for non-African Americans than it does for us. And I just believe that making that shift so that you can actually really defend like any other charge where it is on the state's burden, they bear the burden of proof, this shouldn't be any different. And then it gives you more leverage. And then being in an impossible position to have to say, either give up your Fifth Amendment or face a minimum mandatory is an incredible different position to put a defendant in. So I'd like to speak on their behalf.
Well, Marissa, we are sorry, so sorry for everything that you've been through, but congratulations on being free now and keep doing what you're doing. We're rooting for you. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
You may recall that Roland visited the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center in Cincinnati, Ohio last week. While he was there, the president of the Freedom Center shared the news about a new exhibit that will be opening soon. Here's the conversation with Roland and Dr. Clarence G. Newsom.
All right, doctor, you got some exciting news that you're announcing.
Roland, it's really exciting news. On March 24th, we're going to open the first exhibit on Nelson Mandela in the nation, so far as we know of. It'll be a magnificent exhibit on his life and his leadership. And this is the place for people to come and see what we will be able to share with the public and the world about this great, great man. It is an exhibit that we'll have here on an ongoing basis, and we're also looking to tour it. So we want to interest other museums in receiving this exhibit when it's ready to go out on tour.
And why this particular museum, and how long have you been working on this with the Mandela family?
We've been working with the Mandela family and the foundation for the better part of 3 years. About 3 years ago, we awarded posthumously our highest award to President Mandela, the International Freedom Conductors Award. His great-grandson came over, Luvuyo Mandela, an outstanding young man, and received the award. And we started talking then about how this museum could continue to play a role in lifting up President Mandela as one of the greatest freedom fighters of all time. And inasmuch as we focus on freedom, we felt that he would be a wonderful way to introduce to the world the kind of vision that President Mandela had about freedom. And his grandson really, really wrapped his arms around it. We began talking with one of President Mandela's personal photographers, who brought some photographs over and told us the stories about those photographs. We put those photographs on display, and then we purchased them. And now we've added some other things to this collection. And we want people to put in their calendars, March 24th, the beginning of the Nelson Mandela exhibit here in Cincinnati at the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center. And it is our hope that the Freedom Center will become the center in the United States and North America for perpetuating and promoting the legacy and life of Nelson Mandela.
That is certainly exciting news, and so we certainly appreciate it. And also, so when we did the show Friday, we were talking off air. So why don't you tell everybody who your daughter is? You say, she deserves a shout out. He tells me off air. I'm like, no, you need to say it on air.
Well, I'm so delighted and proud to do that. My daughter is Bree Newsom, the intrepid young lady who was moved by what happened in Charleston, South Carolina, to climb a flagpole in Columbia, South Carolina, as she said, aided by the spirit of her ancestors, climb a flagpole and take down that Confederate flag. And by the way, she had an ancestor who was born on a slave ship in Charleston Harbor.
Now, did you know she was doing, was going to do that before she did it?
I had no idea. I found out like the rest of the world.
And you like, is my daughter on that flagpole?
I went to the television after we got a call and my wife fell out of bed and looked at the picture. And after a while, I said, oh, yes, that is her.
All right.
I'll leave it at that.
All right, then. We appreciate it. All right.
Thank you.
Anyway, thanks so much.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Right.
Okay.
Did y'all see her climb that pole? I'm telling you, the future is female. Still ahead on News One Now, Never Caught explores George Washington's obsession with his runaway slave. The book's author joins us next.
Your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America.
I don't bend, I don't break.
It's News One Now with Roland Martin.
Some say American history has the tendency to whitewash the legacy and image of Founding Father George Washington. There is little discussion about his stance on slavery and his history as a slave owner. The new book, Never Caught, The Washington's Relentless Pursuit of Their Runaway Slave, Onyedjedje, tells the story of Washington's obsession with capturing runaway slave Onyedjedje. The book also touches on colorism and gender within slavery. Joining us now is the author, Erica Armstrong Dunbar. Still on panel, we have Dr. Greg Carr and we have Clint Smith III. Welcome, Erica.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
This book is a story that needs to be told and at a time that needs to be told. And like I said to you during the break, it's not a story, it's history.
It is.
So this is about the George Washington that everybody doesn't know, because we tend to keep our founding fathers up on a pedestal instead of making us human beings. Just tell us a little bit about how you came to this story.
Sure. No, I came across this story when I was researching my first book. And I focus on African American women's history, and I came across a runaway slave advertisement from the president's house in Philadelphia. And I thought, whoa, wait a minute. Why don't I know this story? And who is this woman? They called her Onyedjedje. Her name was Onyedjedje, but Oni was the diminutive, the nickname. And her name was in the ad, and it described her, and I thought, wait a minute, this young woman ran away from the president? What happened? Where did she go? And that sort of led me on this 9-year pursuit of tracking her life and what happened to her once she ran away.
And once she ran away, there was a relentless pursuit, apparently, by the Washington family in order to bring her back. Can you just tell us a little bit? You guys, you got to go out and get the book, but tell us a little bit about the measures and lengths our first president went to in order to get his slave back on the plantation.
I think that's probably probably one of the things that's most surprising about the book is it shows us a different side of George Washington and Martha Washington, because technically Ona was owned by Martha Washington, but George was responsible for the estate. And she made a decision that she, once she found out she was going to be actually given away, she was going to be given away as a wedding gift to one of the Washington's grandchildren. And she said, no, I'm not going to do it. She had lived in Philadelphia and New York for 7 years. She was 22 years old, and she made the decision that she would not return. She would not return to Virginia, and she was no longer going to be enslaved. And so she made that bold and daring decision to run, and she was able to be successful with the help of free blacks in both Philadelphia and Portsmouth, where she ends up traveling to. And it's a story that really, right now, as you said, is so poignant, because here is this 22-year-old enslaved black woman who resisted the president of the United States.
That's right. That's right. And it's a critical story to be told, because we go from this 22-year-old runaway to the 22-year-old we just saw in the last break going up and climbing and taking down a Confederate flag. Look how far we've come. Thank you so much for being with us. Stick around. News One Now. We'll be right back.
The first step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number two, roll out.
The way I roll is, when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with Roland Martin. Roland Martin.
Excellence in Black Hollywood, a News One Now primetime special, airs tonight at 9, 8 Central. Everybody, make sure you tune in for that. Don't miss it. Thank you so much for joining me today. Roland will be back joining you tomorrow from Los Angeles. Enjoy the rest of your day. This is News One Now.
Centerpiece for black thoughts in America.
I don't bend, I don't break.
It's News One Now with Roland Martin.